We've got Gerhard back on the line. So, Gerhard, we'll keep going with the questions. And if any farmers on the line who wants to have a chat, well, they can just come in and interrupt us or make it clear that they're there. So, Gerhard, would you like to go ahead with the questions?
All right. I think we covered the molasses one, did we, Hugo? I mean, when we dropped out, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, no, we covered that. We covered the sulfur part of the molasses.
The sulfur part of the molasses was
I think Gerhard, what you said about molasses is quite pertinent, because I was talking to a gentleman who is a technician in a sugar processing plant, and he said they do use some pretty powerful chemicals in the lines to clean the lines, and he said they also, would you believe, add water to the molasses so that it flows down the line so it can go into the storage tank. So what you think is molasses is pure molasses in the conventional stuff, as it was explained by my technician, there may be some doubt about it, but let's not talk about it anymore. So
All right. Well, the next question then, if we want to move on from there, is, again, this is the last one from Lorraine, and she asks, when making compost, do you have to get the very last leaf to 55 degrees Celsius, or just make sure the heat is out of the compost? No, you need to make sure the heat is in the compost, and it needs to be turned. It needs to be at 55 degrees. By the Australian standard, it needs to be at 55 degrees Celsius or above for 3 days, and then it needs to be turned three times, minimum of three times. So the critical thing is it's got to be above 55 degrees. It's not supposed to get beyond 65 degrees. If it gets beyond about 70 degrees, you actually start doing damage to some of the microorganisms that you want to carry through in the whole process. And it is important that it's turned the three times as a minimum, simply because we do want to try and get every last leaf to 55 degrees. And whether that's every last leaf or every last bit of twig or every last bit of manure, whatever the feedstocks are. And then you regulate the temperature by opening the heap up if it gets too hot and putting water on it again so that the steam that's ejected from that heap or from that pile, the moisture in that steam is replenished, and that's the other purpose of turning, to restore some of that moisture again, get some oxygen back in there, take the heat out, and then allow that process to repeat itself.
Thanks,
and that's done in the first six to 8 weeks,
Yep. Right, Gerhard, we're going to Peter and Kathy's questions.
Okay.
Sadler, there is, from Western Australia.
Yep. What is the most practical way of measuring your nitrogen, your green and woody material in making thermal compost on farm for extraction in broad-scale cropping? Well, I guess it's being familiar with the materials that you've got on hand, and then making a fairly broad assessment about how they're each going to contribute to that final compost. And if you're not sure, you can get your material analysed, but there are a good number of publications out there now, and there may very well be some online as well that you can find. I can't think of any off the top of my head. We certainly have a number of books here that come from Australia and from America that talk about the different nitrogen amounts in different materials, and different manures will have different amounts. So it's about understanding what materials you've got, going back to the literature and looking at that, or getting an analysis done. As far as the material goes, if it's a colour green, you look at it's on a volume basis as well. It's something that you need to be aware of. Weight and volume need to be factored in there. And then the wooden materials, well, depending on the type of woody materials, if you've got hardwoods, they're going to be a lot, they're going to carry a lot more carbon. they're slower growing, then the soft wood that you've got as well. And whether they're pure woody materials or whether they've got some leaf in there from being chipped up, from a whole tree being chipped down, then that would also come into your calculation. One of the things that is important when you're assessing your feedstocks and building your pile is that you look at the sizing of the material. Can the different sizes hold sufficient air and moisture in there to allow the organisms now to start breeding up and developing the heat that's going to be generated as a result of that? And that is very important in your consideration when you're building your pile. So sometimes you need to get a bit of straw or hay in there. If you're in a situation where you're cropping, you would have access to some straw, presumably. Usually you find there's some manures that you get, so whether it's pig manure or cattle manure or sheep manure or poultry manures of different sorts, they all need to be brought into the mix. But if the manures are already very compact because they've come from a feedlot and they've been moved around by machinery, then you need to somehow have larger particle material through there as well that allows the moisture and air to be held in there and the organisms to start building their numbers. All right. The last question from Peter and Kathy is, should we analyse all ingredients for the C-to-N ratio? I guess it gets back to economics, and really if you've got a constant stream of your different ingredients that you can then rationalise it and say, okay, we've got X number of tonnes coming through, we know it's all coming from the same feedlot, we know that feedlot is, their diet mix is constant all year round, and therefore the manure that's coming from that is constant, then it would be worth getting an analysis done. And it would probably be worth asking the feedlot what analysis they may have too, because chances are, for reasons pertaining to their license, they may very well already have those C-to-N ratios there. But, yeah, that's probably, it is important, but whether you actually get the analysis done is really a personal decision based on economics of doing it, and whether the information that you have, broadly speaking, is sufficient. In my lot here, for my own purposes, I don't analyse. I find the material at the end of the day will tell me what results I'm getting, and that works quite well for me. That's not to say if I've got a high-value crop with doing work with trees that might have a value of tens of thousands of dollars, in which case we would say, okay, let's analyse the compost and make sure that what we're delivering is going to be just a result particularly pertinent to getting high quality actively aerated compost teas out there onto those trees. All right. There's a question there from Helen asking how much air do we need for brewing and is a fish tank pump sufficient? That's an interesting question because it really is important to match up based on the work that's been done through the soil food web and knowing that we need to have a minimum, an absolute minimum at all times during the brewing process of 6 parts per million dissolved oxygen, which doesn't sound a lot, but it can be tricky to maintain if you get this big bloom, which you will get if you're making a good compost tea, a big bloom of bacteria taking all the oxygen it can as it's building up its numbers. And so it's not necessarily a simple answer, but in some situations a fish tank pump can be sufficient, but I would speculate that a fish tank pump that would normally deliver sufficient air, oxygen or air into a 200 litre tank would probably be struggling to do a 40 or 50, 60 litre tea brewing tank. And the only way that you're going to confirm that is by using a dissolved oxygen meter and putting a brew or several brews through your brewing equipment and measuring the dissolved oxygen through the whole process so that you know that there's going to be a dip when there's a huge demand of the oxygen and as the food is being consumed and as the organisms build up in numbers and they're not depleting the oxygen that's being delivered in there to the point where the the fish tank pump can no longer deliver that required amount. And that's, in essence, that's the testing that gets done when anyone makes up a brewer.
Gerhard, I think it's we've got to be really clear that people should have the right equipment to do the right job and make sure they've got the right equipment. In other words, you need to have an air pump that does deliver the right amount of air or the oxygen rather than sort of doing something that is doubtful when it comes to pumping the air. Now, Gerhard,
can I just finish off on that too, because
please.
That is very important. And one of the things that I certainly don't want, I've spent a number of years now very strongly promoting the whole concept of biological farming, and I've found over the years, and sometimes quite frustration, that some farmers will go and take some shortcuts and then they come away very disappointed, not understanding what they've done has just destroyed everything that they've worked towards. They've done a lot of things right and then taken one or two shortcuts and found it hasn't worked and they've gone back to their old methods. I'm very clear that, you know, I really want farmers to explore everything that's possible, and sometimes just spending a few extra dollars or making just that little bit of extra effort, and for example, in cleaning equipment, is necessary to get the full benefit. And I certainly don't want them to go back to their old methods, which are not going to be sustainable. You know, whereas this process that we, or this method that we're putting through with compost and compost tea, is in fact resource recovery. It's using it, materials that had no further use, and what we're doing is now we're being clever about how we're putting some value back into those raw materials and building a resource that allows the soil to recover and become healthy again and functional again.
Gerhard, two things we want to get through. One is dissolved oxygen meters. How important is it? Where do people get them? And might describe what a dissolved oxygen meter is. And the second part of the question is that while you were offline, Rick, I want to come back to talk about Rick Preston's question about mycorrhiza. So can you have a bit of a chat about dissolved oxygen meters?
Well, dissolved oxygen meters are simply a piece of equipment that most of them actually have the ability to measure the temperature of the brew or the liquid that they're designed to measure the dissolved oxygen in. It's an electrode that sits in the liquid. As I said, it does measure temperature as well, and it will measure, and even some of the simpler ones will do a data logging of the dissolved oxygen levels that are in that liquid for the time that the electrode is submerged in it. We've got some inexpensive ones, relatively inexpensive. They're sort of in the $700 mark. Sounds like a bit of money, but again, it's a piece of equipment that should last you many, many years, so it becomes quite an inexpensive piece of equipment. And we've got some top-end pieces of equipment that are very, very robust, and certainly in a situation where farm businesses are run with employees and transients who, you know, just told to use this piece of equipment, they're a lot more robust, and they're around the $3,000 mark. Again, it sounds like a bit of money, but when you've got the likes of Mike Harrison with the work that he's done, then that becomes a drop in the ocean in the context of the benefits that he's been able to achieve on that farm. Dissolved oxygen meters are available out there. Have a look in the marketplace. Agri Solutions on our website, we do have them as well, and certainly people are welcome to have a look there and just see what we're offering and then compare to what else is on the market. There are two types. There's a membrane type, and they're the cheaper ones because you do have to replace those membranes and you do have to calibrate. And then there's the electrode type, which is the $3,000 unit, which you know, you could expect easily 10 years of life out of it as well. But they do need to be handled with a bit of care because they are a piece of scientific equipment.
Gerhard?
Yep.
Sorry, keep talking. Finish off and then I'll...
No, I've finished. Thanks. Here you go. Well, there was another part of the question, was there?
Yes, but I'm going to open up the line, and Rick is online, so he may ask the question. If he doesn't ask the question, I shall ask the question about mycorrhiza. So, Rick, are you there? Can you got your question for the about the mycorrhiza for Gerhard?
Oh, you asked the question.
All right, all right.
Hello there, Rick.
G'day, Gerhard.
What's happening, Rick, is that we had to close off the lines because we're getting too much static type of interruptions. So if that comes back on, I will close it. But in the meantime, I won't close it. So you're available to talk to Gerhard. Rick asked the question of, I think it was the question, my memory doesn't serve me so well, that was only a few seconds ago he asked, was how do you test for mycorrhiza? Or how do you know there's mycorrhiza there? Or what sort of equipment do you need to test, and I think that was related to the microscope conversation we had. So can you elaborate on the mycorrhiza, how you test, how would you know it was there, and what's involved using a microscope to see the mycorrhiza?
Rick, at this stage, I would not be confident that a layman would be able to get the microscope and look for and find mycorrhizae. There needs to be a little bit more expertise learned and practiced, and that's where the lab comes in. They actually need to stain the roots of the plants. They need samples of roots, and then they need to stain the roots of the plants, and they have certain phosphorescence that are used, and then the internals of the plant roots are then viewed and then assessments made whether there's mycorrhiza colonisation or not. I know that even in the field, people look at some of their soils and say, oh, we've got mycorrhiza. I think that's probably stretching the bow a little bit, but then I'm getting on a bit, my eyesight's sort of going downhill a bit too. So maybe the younger people have that capacity. But to be sure, I would always refer back to the laboratory to make that call.
Gerhard, what you just said, according to the literature I've read, that you've got different fungi doing different roles, and one particular fungi, mm-hmm. as you just intimated, was that actually penetrate inside the root of the plant. So naturally, that's not going to be that easy for a lay person to see that connection or what's on the inside of the root. What do you think, Gerhard?
That's correct, yeah, most definitely. And that's important that we recognise that we can only do so much before we need to bring the people who are trained to do it with the right equipment to make that call. And it is about the ability to look inside the actual root structure. What when you say it actually goes into the root, it goes between the cells of the root. It doesn't go into the cell itself, but goes between the cells. And that's the endomycorrhiza, the ectomycorrhiza wrap themselves, in effect, right, wrap themselves around the outside of the root and then become an extension of the root system.
Okay, Gerhard, I'm not going to debate that because I have read contradictory information for this conversation. It's not relevant to tease that too far apart.
Okay.
Rick, you're still online. Is there anything you'd like to ask Gerhard, our expert in the area from composting right through to microscope?
Yeah, hello, Gerhard.
G'day, Rick.
We remember we did a soil test here on our property last year, and results came back that we didn't have any mycorrhiza fungi evident.
Yep.
And I was just interested to maybe get some samples, say, along the railway line or off the road where there's been no chemicals or artificial fertilisers, and seeing if there's mycorrhizal fungi existing in those corridors. I have access to a chap not far away that belongs to the Society of Microscopic Institution of Australia or something like that, and I'm sure he'd be able to identify it. I mean, I just wonder whether it'd be a worthwhile exercise.
If it's a worthwhile exercise, most definitely. And in fact, if if you've identified that you've actually got mycorrhizal fungi supported in those plants that you've got there, then there will be a natural progression of colonisation into the paddocks from that area. But what you can also do is when you've got actively growing plants, you could in fact get some samples of roots, or you know, dig a few root samples that you can take out of those areas once you've identified it, and start to inoculate your paddocks further in as well.
Again, yeah. How would you actually inoculate the paddocks with mycorrhizal fungi that Rick has found, in various reserves that haven't been disturbed? How would you actually physically do it?
Just get small amounts. I mean, even a teaspoonful of a soil that's got roots in there as well from the host area, and just wherever the roots in the root zone, like in the first 3 or 4 centimetres that you've got actively growing plants, just put the material in amongst that so that you're in the root zone with that material, and that should be enough to get a couple of the spores at least to start to find the actively growing roots and then start to colonise them. Doesn't take much at all. There are the commercial brews that are out there, and unfortunately they're very limited with the number of species, and they may not colonise depending on the host conditions and the soil conditions. So if you've got some that are there that are indigenous, then a lot of them are plant specific, so we need to be mindful of that. But generally, if you've got grass species there that are supporting grasses, and you've got grasses that you're trying to grow, or cereal crops that are closely related to grasses, then there's a good chance that they will do the job for you.
Gerhard, Rick, is it okay? I think we've want to wind up this call because we'd like to keep this to an hour, otherwise it goes on to two discs, and that means running around with two discs in your equipment when you're out in the field. So I'm going to close. So, Rick, thank you very much. I am going to close
fine,
off.
Here,
no, thanks a lot again, Rick.
Okay.
I'll talk with you later on too, Rick, if you like.
No, I've taken him off there, Rick. I've taken off there, Gerhard. Gerhard, I'd like to close off now. Thank you very much for coming to the call. And the interesting thing was that Sir Albert Howard did a lot of work. He's a mycologist, and he was a very active scientist, plus a field worker. In other words, he put all his scientific work out in the field, and he put out two very interesting documentations. One was called An Agricultural Testament, was put out in 1933, and he was talking about his how much emphasis the mycorrhiza how important mycorrhiza was in the soil and for all plant health. So anyway, I'd just like to wind up this conversation. And Gerhard, if you've got any words of wisdom, which I know you have, you might like to say those before we wind up.
Oh, I'm at a loss. I actually feel that, I've said probably as much as I can. I can't even think how I can maybe add some more to this conversation. It's been great. Good to have Rick there as well and throwing questions at us. But in essence, anyone that might be questioning the value of compost or compost tea, if nothing else, should at least do a little trial plot somewhere and just look for themselves what they're going to achieve in a small area. And in fact, when I work with farmers who are willing to sort of go the whole hog, I say, no, at least put a bit of ground away that will be your control so you can compare, and don't rely on the neighbours to compare if you can help it. But either way, you know, it's about doing it in steps that you're comfortable with and looking for results and not expecting a quick fix solution there either. Even though often we do get quick fixes, which are a bit of a bonus really more than anything else, but it's the long term that we're looking for and getting results happening to use the power of the microorganism.
Mm. Now, Gerhard, the knowledge that farmers pick up by doing work with the microbes or fungi, the bacteria and fungi or all the other all things, it stays with the farmer for life, and it also gets the farmer to use less and less commercial products to the point that the farmer can be more profitable. So, Gerhard, I'm going to have you wind up, and I'm going to wind up. So what's your parting words?
My parting words are that we really need to acknowledge and begin to well manage the micro life that's out there upon which we all depend in various ways, and not to be frightened by this current outbreak of, I think it's E. coli that's happening at the moment over in Europe, and everyone's running scared, to recognise they've got a role to play as well, but by well managing the aerobic systems of compost and compost tea, we would naturally deal with those disease bombers as well. So people shouldn't be, be scared or afraid of heading down this path, because it is an exciting way to manage our landscape and provide something for the future that will be better than what we currently have.
Gerhard, thank you very much for that. And the fact that you bring up something like this E. coli scare in Europe, what happens with quite a lot of these scares is commercial products are brought into the thing, industry starts getting it, taking advantage of it, and the reverse side of it is what Gerhard is telling us, that farmers don't have to panic. In most cases, they do not have to panic. There's a natural answer, and working with your bacteria, fungi, and other soil life is the answer, rather than panicking buying some commercial product. Sorry to get on my soapbox to say that, but commercialism is, in many cases, is an absolute fraud for the farmer, that is, and for anyone else's good health. So on that basis, I am going to say goodbye, and I'd like to thank all the farmers who have been listening and the farmers who have sent in their questions. And we just, both Gerhard and myself and other people, really just like farmers to take a natural approach and become the winners, be in control of their destiny by understanding or by working with the soil life. So it's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from him.
Good. Thanks, Gerhard. And just thank all the farmers who have been listening.
Yes, thank you, too.